Thank you very much. I should first of all say that this talk is organized in a fairly chaotic sense. In the following sense, I put in too much material. I hope that you'll interrupt me, and I expect not to finish. So this is probably more or less the outline.
That's good tradition.
Secondly, I should say that when I'm talking about classical in the sense of nucleation, I'm not at all talking about the distinction between quantum and classical, but the distinction between a classical theory as defined by the people who make the new theory and then call everything that went before classical. Okay. Okay, so let me just briefly give an outline of the kind of things I'll be talking about. I'll be talking about computer simulation. I'll tell you pretty much nothing about computer simulation as such, about the techniques. I'm perfectly happy to go into the details if you want to, but I will try to focus as much as possible on the kind of physics that we can study using the simulations. And in particular, I'll talk about a field of nucleation. I will give a brief review of simulation of nucleation as such. I'll talk about the classical theory, the kind of theory that was developed some 80 years ago now when people started to form a picture of what was actually happening during nucleation. A number of rules are very important. The field Ostwald's rule is actually even older than the classical nucleation theory. It's 1897. The Alexander McTague, well, I wouldn't call it a rule, but a conjecture, that of course is like now some 20 years old. Turnbull's rule, I'll come back to that, and I'll talk about the nucleation theorem. All kind of things that sort of folklore that has sprung up in the field and that using simulation you can say something about. In the end, I'm not sure whether I come up with a very coherent picture of what's actually going on, because we find that some of these pictures sometimes apply and often they don't apply, and so nucleation is just a bit more complex than what we had expected before. But that's the advantage of actually doing simulation. You can look in detail at things that we could not look at before, and we found that life is different. Okay. Before I go on, I'll talk about Ostwald's rule, and actually I should in a sense apologize to Ostwald, because certainly Ostwald would not have liked my talk. Now, why is it that Ostwald would not have liked my talk? Ostwald, whom you may remember, was one of the founders of physical chemistry. He did not believe in atoms, and I'm a computer simulator, so I really have to assume that atoms exist. And Ostwald was of the old German positivist school, and he said that only energy is real. And so he said believing in atoms is like worshipping idols. It was a very strong, almost religious statement that atoms should never be invoked to explain anything. But I mean, it must be said, usually you say that when a new theory comes, that the old ideas don't disappear because people get convinced, but because they die. In Ostwald's case, it's not quite true, because after Perrin's experiments, he accepted that atoms do exist, or at least are a useful concept.
But too late for Boltzmann.
Too late for Boltzmann, yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the reason why I defy Ostwald is really that I think that by doing simulation, you can tell something about the phenomenon of nucleation that experiments cannot tell us, and I add yet, because the situation is really changing rapidly in the sense that the crucial stages of nucleation, I'll come back to in a minute, the formation of a critical nucleus, is something that until really quite recently was totally outside the scope of any experiment, but now in particular if you look at slow dynamics and colloidal systems, people can start to probe precisely the critical stage of nucleation, and therefore whatever I'm going to say is not something that's totally untestable, and I'll show you some comparisons with experiments, and I'll tell you beforehand, all the comparisons turn out to be disastrous. So it's really exciting, this field. Okay, the background. I mean, I suppose that many of you know it, but it's probably useful to go over the basis of nucleation. I'll use this hardware pointer. The classical theory of nucleation, which actually is a very, very useful and powerful theory. Now, the first thing you have to wonder is, the simple question, why is it that I have a glass of water, I put it outside on a cold night, at least cold night in the Netherlands, I think that here it usually doesn't freeze even on a cold night. If you don't shake it, you don't stir it, you don't drop anything into it, next morning it will still be liquid. And so actually water you can cool down if you're sufficiently careful to something like minus 36 degrees centigrade before it really spontaneously crystallizes. So there is a reason why, even though ice is more stable, you don't spontaneously transform from water to ice. Now, the classical nucleation theory of nucleation is a macroscopic thermodynamic-like theory, and it says the following. Suppose that here I have water, which is less stable, or liquid, less stable than the solid phase. That means the chemical potential of the liquid is higher than that of the solid. Whenever I now transfer molecules from the liquid to the solid, that will lower the free energy system, because the chemical potential is lower here. The only problem is that as you transfer, any nucleus, any crystal that you form has to start small. So you can transfer molecules from liquid to solid, but in doing so, you also create surface. And creation of the surface always costs free energy. And now the essence of the theory, the classical nucleation theory, is simply that it says, well, whatever I gain goes with the volume, so it goes as r cubed. Whatever I have to pay goes with the surface, goes as r squared. And initially, r squared wins. So the gain term is, well, the volume of the nucleus times the density times the chemical potential difference, negative. And the loss term, what you have to pay, is the surface area times the interfacial free energy. You combine the two things, and you get this this nice picture. Initially, you see the surface term dominating. At some point, the bulk term kicks in and takes over. And the point where they're just about balancing is the top of the barrier. And the height of the barrier really determines what is the probability that due to a spontaneous fluctuation, you'll get a cluster, a crystalline cluster of this size, that then can go on and roll down this free energy hill in this direction. Because whenever you have a spontaneous fluctuation that brings you only here, then most likely you'll roll down in this direction. So the probability goes as this height, the free energy formation nucleus, over kT, and that goes on the exponent. So it's an exponential minus delta G over kT. And the important thing to note is that apart from constants, and I'll say just one joke about the constants, but apart from the constants, this barrier goes as the interfacial free energy to the third power, so it depends very strongly on the interfacial free energy, and it goes as delta mu, the difference, the driving force, the thermodynamic driving force, over to the power minus 2. And that means that at coexistence, where mu solid is mu liquid, this term is zero, and therefore the barrier is infinite. This is why if you put water around when it's just about freezing, when you put water outside, it will never freeze because the barrier is just incredibly large. Even if you have real nucleation experiments where people see a million nuclei forming per cubic centimeter per second, these barriers typically are still of the order of 50 to 70 times the thermal energy. Very, very high barriers. It's extremely difficult to cross them. Now, the comment I wanted to make is that I once showed this same transparency to a community of protein crystallographers who do protein crystallization, and they objected to this transparency very strongly. And they said, you cannot show this kind of transparency because it's a transparency to degree 5, and you should never do that in our company. Now, for people with a more biomedical background, apparently when they see transparencies generated by physicists, they determine the degree as follows. They just count the number of Greek symbols, so it's very easy. One is acceptable, two is the danger zone, anything beyond 3 is unacceptable, so be careful. Well, this is my last transparency of degree 5.
Just before you move from it, though, this is far from any critical effect, right?
Yes, absolutely.
You might have imagined that, although often you are far from critical effects, you're talking about pretty small nuclei, and you might worry about how it compares with nuclei, with correlation lengths and so on.
Yes, well, actually, the thing is that there is certainly, if you talk about nucleation of a liquid from a vapor, then the only regime where you see nucleation is between the binodal, the coexistence curve, and the spinodal, where you get spontaneous phase separation, even though the spinodal only in mean field is well defined. That regime, of course, shrinks to nothing as you go to the critical point. So the nucleation regime as such becomes a bit strange close to the critical point, although I'll come back to that in a minute when I talk about crystallization close to a liquid vapor critical point, because there it is important. Okay, so the main message of the whole classical nucleation theory at this moment is that this barrier height that determines the probability of fluctuation goes as 1 over delta mu squared, so it means that at coexistence the barrier is infinite, and it goes down very, very steeply, and this is why nucleation seems to be almost a phase transition. You see nothing, you cool by 1 degree, and the whole sample is filled with crystals. And that's just because of this very strong exponential dependence on delta mu. Okay, now I will not talk about experiments. Well, I'll mention experiments, but mainly I will not talk about experiments on nucleation. I'll talk about simulations. And there's a special problem in doing a simulation of crystal nucleation, and that is that simulations typically don't deal with 10 to the 23 atoms or molecules, but maybe 1,000, 10,000. If you work very hard, you use 1,000,000. And then you can simulate for maybe a few nanoseconds, and if you try extremely hard, maybe a microsecond. Now, if you talk about experimental nucleation rates, then typically most experiments deal with rates where you have between 1 and 1,000,000, in some cases up to 1 billion nuclei forming per cubic centimeter per second. But say about, well, here I say of the order of 1, but even if you take of the order of 1,000,000 nuclei per cubic centimeter, and you go not to a volume of a cubic centimeter, but you go to a typical simulation volume, where it is of the order of 10 minus 15 cubic centimeter, it means that 1 nucleus per cubic centimeter per second would mean in this very small simulation system, I will have to wait for 10 to the 15 seconds before I maybe see one nucleation event. And that is real seconds. Now, you know that in a simulation, you actually discretize times in times of the order of a femtosecond. So you easily have to compute of the order of 10 to the 30 molecular dynamics time steps before maybe or maybe not you will see one nucleation event. And that is simply to show that completely brute force techniques will not allow you to study nucleation under the realistic conditions that people could study in experiment. Now, I will not say anything about the techniques that you can use to overcome that problem, just indicate what the kind of approach you follow. The nucleation rate, in general, you can write as this, basically the pre-factor, the exponential factor that tells you what the probability is that you'll have a spontaneous fluctuation in equilibrium forming this nucleus, and a pre-factor, a rate factor, that contains, first of all the simple dynamic factors that you would expect if you have something that goes over the top of the barrier, but it also contains corrections due to the fact that you don't have equilibrium between the top of the barrier and the initial state, but it's actually a steady state flux, so this is the Zeldovich corrections. All these things are known in principle, and in a simulation what you would have to do is to first compute this barrier, but this barrier you can compute with effectively fairly standard Bayes Monte Carlo techniques, or if you wish, molecular dynamics techniques. So you don't have to wait for the system to climb up the barrier, you simply force the system slowly up the barrier, and at every stage you compute how much free energy that costs, and this way you can really map out a complete free energy barrier for nucleation. Once you have the barrier, you know the top of the barrier, you put the system at the top, and you look at the rate at which it is transmitted from the top of the barrier into the basin that is the crystal. So you look at what rate you go from the top of the barrier on to form a crystal. These things are fairly cheap to compute because you don't have to wait for a rare event. And so the combination is also doable. Yes?
Clarifying question.
Yeah.
In order to force the system up the barrier, yeah, using Bayes Monte Carlo, don't you need to know the trajectory?
Yes and no. That's the in principle, of course, you don't want to bias the system in such a way that you force it to nucleate through a particular pathway. So what we always have to, well, there are several approaches to this problem, because it's the general problem that plagues the simulation of rare events. And the thing that we try to do is to define an order parameter that distinguishes between liquid and solid, but doesn't distinguish between different crystalline structures in such a way that we know we start with crystallinity 0, we end up with crystallinity 1, and we allow the system itself to explore what crystalline structures it wants to take while going there. Now, there are other techniques. In particular, David Chandler at Berkeley has developed a technique that he calls transition path sampling that is supposedly free of any such bias. Unfortunately, for this kind of calculation, that technique is so expensive that nobody until now has been able to make it work. So that's it.
And how strong the answer will depend on your definition of order parameter?
If you look carefully, the actual barrier height itself may depend slightly on the definition of the order parameter. Maybe I should just draw something on the blackboard then. Can I, some light somewhere? So, I should write it on your side, that's more. Suppose that this is the order parameter that I use, and this is the liquid, and this is the solid according to my definition. But in fact, it turns out that there's another order parameter, order parameter 2, that is also very important. And so I start somewhere here, and in fact, my crystalline sample is, for instance, the crystalline state is here. If I discretize space like this, and the actual sort of path that I follow, for instance, is this, then in principle, you can still compute the total free energy surface. Of course, it will be different if you do if the path is this or that, because you'll be projecting different directions of the coordinate onto the reaction path. This should not be a problem. If, on the other hand, the reaction path is this, you may expect to see something very strange. You will still compute something that looks like a nucleation barrier, but then what you will find is that, for instance, if you're here, you find that certain samples always go back in this direction and certain samples always go on in that direction. So there is actually a test that you can do in simulation that allows you to see whether you're in this situation. Now you take a particular point in space and you do 1,000 runs starting from that point. If you find that all 1,000 go back to the initial state or all go on to the final state, you know that your reaction coordinate is not close to the true trajectory. So one way of testing whether we do things right is precisely this kind of test, and to see whether near the top of the barrier it's really for every point 50-50. I must admit we don't always do that because that test is more expensive than the simulation itself.
So you're just checking right near the top, you're spending around the top of the barrier, you're not really checking the trajectory.
We check the entire, we do the whole thing. We need it to do the free energy calculation. We need to have to follow the whole.
And the order parameter is a scalar.
The order parameter in this, yes, it is a scalar. It need not be a scalar, but in this case it is a scalar, yes.
If you pick a felt order parameter, let's say.
Yeah.
And draw a trajectory in 3D space, yeah. And then you project it to 2D space, yeah. You expect error of the same order?
Yes, and I would say that in general, if you would have that kind of problem, it would show up as a very inefficient sampling of the trajectories, and then well, the one way would be to use something like transition path sampling, where you basically try to allow the system itself to find the right trajectories. It should be possible in principle, but for several reasons, it's very difficult to apply it to nucleation. The other thing is that you simply try to see in what respects the time evolution of the system differs from what you expect, and try to use that information to define the additional order parameters, to just see what coordinates orthogonal to the ones you've chosen seem to be active in the dynamics. I must say that in most cases, sometimes we define additional order parameters. I'll show an example. It is not always easy to come up with better definitions, and I would say that there is still a certain amount of choice in selecting the order parameters involved. The only thing that is you should always bear in mind is that even if you do things completely wrong, in the sense you take really stupid order parameters, as long as this is your initial condition and this is your final condition, the answer you get will be right when you look at the rates. The barrier itself may be slightly wrong. The transmission coefficient itself may be slightly wrong. The product of the probability to cross the barrier and the transmission rate, that product should be independent of whatever coordinates you have chosen, because that's a physical observable. And so the calculation may be inefficient, but not wrong. Okay, so that's maybe I should switch off the light again. So where
was it? Right there.
This one. Okay, good. Okay, so this is just the kind of thing. Here you see, this is actually for a colloidal system, an example of a critical nucleus. And I show it for two reasons. First of all, you see that actually, although it looks quite rough on the outside, it does have crystal planes, so your temporary wind rotates, but you can see the crystal planes. Secondly, you see, for instance, this particle that seems to be slightly disconnected from the nucleus. You say, I mean, how can I say that this belongs to the nucleus? All the particles that, according to the our order parameter definition, are liquid-like are not shown. And the only thing is that what I've shown is that in the simulation, you need a criterion for what is solid and what is liquid. We use something based on order parameter, on bond order parameters, so we look at the local environment of a particle and see, look at the different spherical harmonic expansion of the local density. And on basis of that that kind of order parameter, we tell that say that a particle is either solid or liquid. And according to the computer, this particle was solid, and so I simply show it. So I mean, just to show that I'm honest. Okay.
So how locally defined the parameter is defined for each atom?
Yeah, so what you basically do is for every atom, you look at the local bond, so you look at the nearest neighbors. Sorry?
The local Voronoi sphere.
Well, it's not quite the Voronoi, but you could use Voronoi. We tried Voronoi, we found actually that the spherical harmonics, so you can make different scalars out of the local spherical harmonics based on the local bond vectors between two particles, and we find that the sixth order spherical harmonic you can either make the simple invariant just a square, or you can make the third order invariant. We found that the second order invariant has a nice property that it really doesn't distinguish too much between different crystal structures, whereas the other ones we then later on use to distinguish between different crystal structures.
And you only do single point, you don't look at any two-point correlations.
Basically a bond order parameter itself is already a two-point correlator, but then actually when we decide whether a particle is in a solid or liquid-like environment, we define its own bond order parameter, which actually is in this case a set of, in the case of L equals 6, of 13 different components, and we basically look at the dot product between the local bond order parameter in this particle and its neighboring particles, and if they are in phase, we say they apparently belong to a similar crystal structure, and on that basis actually then we do a kind of majority rule counting. If a particle has only a small number of correlated particles that are in environment correlated, we say it is most likely liquid-like, and if it's above a certain threshold, it's solid-like. And this we tested by doing simulations on pure liquids and pure solid, and we found that there's a very clear gap between what typically the environment of a liquid-like particle is and typically the environment of a solid-like particle. So we are pretty sure that we at least could uniquely define in a liquid all particles as being liquid and in a solid all particles as being solid.
Is
there? Yes.
Do you live in the simulation? Do you have an ensemble that describes the critical state, or do you literally have a single mechanical state? That is that picture chosen somewhat randomly?
No. Oh, there, I have movies, extremely boring movies, where you see this thing fluctuating all the time. So it's an ensemble of states. Yes. Yes.
What's the bulk volume fraction here?
Typically for this kind of situation, I would guess that it's 52% volume fraction for the hard sphere colloids. Okay, so now we talk about the rules. First, Ostwald's rule. So what was observed already, you should remember that nucleation has been studied pretty much from the moment that people started to look at temperature. Fahrenheit was actually, to my knowledge, the first person who started looking at supercooling and nucleation. Ostwald studied it quite extensively, and he observed that very often if you have a metastable phase, you nucleate a new phase, that the phase that nucleates is not the one that is most stable. But according to Ostwald, his famous step rule of 1897, the phase that nucleates is the one that is closest in free energy to the parent phase. So you first go from the metastable phase, you go down to the an intermediate phase, and finally, if you wait long enough, you go all the way to the stable phase. Now, after the introduction of classical nucleation theory, Ostwald's rule was reformulated by Stransky and Turtomanov in the 1930s, and basically what they say is the phase that nucleates is the one with the lowest nucleation barrier. It's I'd say almost a tautology. I mean, basically it says what nucleates fastest, what you'll see. But okay. Then a more specific prediction for nucleation of crystals was made by Alexander McTaig just about 20 years ago, who considered the solid starting from the liquid point of view. So they set a a solid you can consider as a liquid with periodic density fluctuations, and they use Landau theory to write down a free energy of the solid as a slightly perturbed liquid. And then they simply looked at what kind of fluctuations would be easiest, and they went up to third order in Landau theory and concluded that there would be three crystalline phases that would be uniquely favored to form. First of all, the hexagonal, so a pattern of triangles, hexagonal crystal structure, which is in fact true for all simple 2D crystalline system. If you take a two-dimensional liquid and you increase the density, apart from all the complexities, the tendency to form this kind of hexagonal structure is overwhelming. The second structure they concluded could be interesting was icosahedral, but then they rejected the possibility of any icosahedral structure in the crystal out of hand, which they later regretted very much after quasar crystals had to be discovered. And then they came up with the BCC crystal. And so the BCC crystal in 3D is the structure that, on basis of Landau theory, you would expect to nucleate particularly easily. And so I'll come back to that in a minute. We will see, we have situations where Ostwald and Alexander McTague really predict different things. Stronsky and Totomanov, I would say, they don't really predict something, they just say the lowest barrier is the lowest barrier. So the examples I will show simply as illustrations how the picture can be different from what classical nucleation theory would say are one about, not at all, but crystallization, but condensation of polar liquids, and I'll give two examples of crystallization, and then I'll also talk later on a bit about comparison with experiment. Okay, why polar liquids? Well, much of the practical applications of classical nucleation theories are those that people use in the petrochemical industry. They have to transport fluids, mixes of gases. They have to distill mixes of volatile compounds, and you want to know when suddenly out of a vapor liquid will form. And it turns out that many of the fluids that they have to consider are mixes of nonpolar components, simple hydrocarbons, and polar components. And classical nucleation theory has been tested for these different systems, and it's found that although it works quite well for most simple nonpolar molecules, for the polar molecules, I've drawn here acetonitrile, it's also nitrobenzene, etc., classical nucleation theory does not work well. I would love to have put water here as well, but water is such a strange molecule that in this case, it's for a reason that I don't understand, actually works. It is reasonably well described by classical nucleation theory. So let's take the other polar molecules. So classical nucleation theory doesn't work very well. And people realize this, and so they said, well, probably the nucleus is a bit different from what classical nucleation theory would say. And classical nucleation theory says a nucleus is like a small droplet of the bulk phase. And so there were theories that actually the nucleus would be ferroelectric or deformed or whatever.
And this is referring to liquid vapor?
This is liquid vapor, yes, yes. So in this case, we took an extremely simple model of a polar liquid, but actually one that is extensively used in chemical engineering, namely the so-called Stockmeyer fluid, in which case you describe a polar molecule as a Lennard-Jones particle, so it's argon-like particle, with an embedded dipole. And actually for many simple molecules, people have computed the Stockmeyer parameters and fitted them to experiments, so it's not a totally bizarre model for simple polar liquids. And what you expect to see, here I've drawn my small molecule and I've drawn the dipole by a red-green distinction in the molecule, so you can see this distinguished head and tail. And you expect that as you cross the barrier, of course, if you look at molecules, you don't see a perfectly spherical droplet, but you expect to see a small, more or less spherical cluster. Then you go to the critical nucleus, it's somewhat larger, and if you're beyond that, you see an even larger, well, small droplet. That, of course, fluctuates in time. Now, that is not at all what the simulation showed, and that was quite surprising. What we found is that if you are just before the critical, so you start going up this free energy barrier, you have a relatively small cluster, but not still, this is of the order of more than something like 12 particles. You're not yet at the top of the barrier, and you find that actually these dipoles form a string, like a living polymer. It's not always linear, it can be branched, it fluctuates. Completely different from the droplet picture. And then as you make the nucleus larger, and it depends on what the conditions are where the critical nucleus is, but here we looked at a situation where this is the size of the critical nucleus, then it, you see this string collapses into something that's more compact, but the surface is still very hairy. It's like you have a hairy droplet. Now, you can say, okay, this is a nice picture, but if we then compute the free energy of this cluster and compare it to what you predict on basis of classical nucleation theory, we computed the bulk surface free energy, we computed the bulk chemical potential, then you find that indeed the free energy of this object is quite different from what classical nucleation theory would predict. So the fact that the surface structure of this nucleus is different from that of a bulk liquid really shows up in the nucleation barrier.
Is it different because the surface, if you try to say what the bulk term was, would you be reasonably close to the classical result?
The point is that you can't really distinguish. The thing is, the bulk term, the delta mu, is something that you impose. So you don't. The only thing you can compute that you can derive from your simulations, you find the barrier height, you know what delta mu is, and then you say, if I assume classical nucleation theory, it gives me an interfacial free energy. But it's not that in this droplet you can easily determine an interfacial free energy, apart from the very fact that in curved surfaces, the definition of surface tension is always a fairly subtle matter.
Well, put a different way, okay. Can you or can you not see differences in the structure inside that thing, how droplets are, how the dipoles are correlated.
We checked whether this thing would be ferroelectric. It's not. There's so we didn't see any very interesting dipolar structure in the liquid. But as always, when you get close to a surface, you see some effect of the surface on the internal structure of the liquid. So the answer is a bit, but not something that immediately struck us as very important. Yes?
Two questions. First, how do you identify the atoms that are part of a nuclei for this model?
OK, here it's simply distance. So if they're within a certain range of other particle, then we say they belong to the cluster.
So you don't look at correlations of the dipole?
No, we didn't want to put that in at all.
So it's purely the distance between?
Yes, center of mass distance.
Between two?
Of two particles, yes. Yeah.
And the second is, have you looked at the fractal structure of this nuclei?
No. Well, that's also a matter of taste. But I would not expect that this kind of object has a truly fractal structure. And so
surface fractal. Because if the surface is smooth, your classical theory has to work.
Sorry?
If the surface is smooth, the classical theory has to work.
Well, the thing is that the classical theory. Well, I think that what you'll see, there's two ways of saying that the classical theory still works. And one way is saying, yes, you can still say that on average this surface is smooth. And actually, I believe that that's true. But only the surface interfacial free energy depends on curvature. And the way it, and this hairiness is like a manifestation of how curvature can affect the local structure in the surface and thereby the surface
right,
energy.
Right, which the surface fractal is the description of, right?
Okay, I mean, maybe we should discuss that later. I would be hesitant. I think that simply the range of length scales that we would have available here is too limited to say anything meaningful about fractal structures. So this is why I didn't do so. But at the same, I shouldn't discuss it, go too far, because I simply didn't look, because I thought there was nothing there to look for. So,
do you have a sense of how important macroscopic charge is, that is, how close to neutral the surface is? I might expect some divergence in the polarization. Is that part of what's making this thing different from neutral?
No, again, we looked for dipoles, so whether it was any longer range dipolar correlation in the droplet, we found that actually it's pretty much like in the bulk liquid. There's some effect of the surface on the polarization, but it's not very strong at all. I think that if you look at the flat surface, then the polarization changes sign as you cross the surface, but so there's the net effect is very small. So the main thing is that, or the main one of the things that is that in this case you find that this is not directly what Ostwald's rule would say, because Ostwald would say you form a nucleus of a metastable phase. In this case, there is no obvious metastable phase, although I'll come back to it in a minute. What we find is that pre-critical nuclei have a different structure from the bulk phase, and this I will, for the time being, call a metastable phase. And the critical nucleus, there you see that the bulk looks like the normal liquid, but the surface looks like a different phase. And now I have to explain why I call this a metastable phase, or it's maybe I shouldn't use the word metastable, but a phase that is somehow close in parameter space. And that is a phase that people have been studying most recently in systems of dipolar hard sphere. So you take a hard sphere with an embedded dipole, and there's a fairly old discussion now about whether this system has a liquid vapor transition. And so there's several predictions. Degen predicted yes, and then there was a number of theories that said it should not be so. Simulations basically got stuck because they all found that these dipolar hard spheres form gels. They may have branch points, but they form long linear strings of dipoles that occasionally branch and entangle. For the Stockmeyer fluid that I showed you, this is not a stable phase. It may be close in some sense. So if you make the dipolar interaction relatively strong, eventually it will go and form these phases. But where we were, this is not a stable phase. But clearly, the kind of pre-critical nuclei that we form strongly resemble small bits of this metastable, of this gel phase that you find for dipolar hard sphere. So we have the impression that in nucleation, you form a phase that, for this particular system, is not thermodynamically stable, but close in parameter space.
We have two parameters. We have the Nernst parameters and the dipole.
Yes.
So in principle, you can vary both of them, and you'll be crossing the vapor liquid along different lines.
Yes, that's
one
right.
One of them would be a classical Nernst filter without dipole. Yep. Another would be this transition.
Yes.
You're doing it at some angle. And so my question is are you trying to mix the two phase? Are the two phase transitions at the same universality class? Or are you trying to have some kind of a mixture?
Okay, let me try to. What you can do, what people have done at least, is to look at the critical temperature as a function of, let's write it as a function of the ratio of the Lennard-Jones energy divided by the dipolar energy, sufficiently vaguely defined that I don't have to work out what all the constants are. But you can imagine it's something like mu squared over a critical distance. If you start here with the Lennard-Jones critical point, so this is here the ratio. Oh, sorry, here the ratio should be infinite, actually. So maybe this is not such a fortunate way of representing it. But you start here at the Lennard-Jones critical point, and then you go, and you find that this line goes down and down and down. At some point, the simulations get into this gel, and they can't follow. So we don't know whether this happens or that happens. But where we are is somewhere here. And so we cool down and into this regime. The gel phase presumably is, if it's, well, here it's certainly not, so it presumably is somewhere in this regime, the stable or the state. Well, the you look.
There are three phases. Oh, sure. Basically, it's a more complex diagram because you have three different phases.
Yeah.
You have a gel phase, and a vapor.
Yeah.
And there's a tri-critical point, and you have to.
Well, the gel, I wouldn't involve that, wouldn't consider to be a true phase transition. It's just, it's more like a rigidity percolation.
What happens to this as it cools down to zero?
Nobody knows. I really don't know. I mean, you can compute, the thing is that you can compute the ground state of the dense packed dipolar crystal, which I guess eventually will always win from this kind of dilute phases. So what at zero Kelvin I expect ideal gas coexisting with a dense packed crystal. But somewhere in between these phases will show up. And whether they're equilibrium phases or not, I don't know. Okay, second example. And now we come to this point of the possibility of a critical point doing something to nucleation. And the example actually has to do with crystallization of globular proteins, which people find extremely important because of all the genomes that now have been unraveled, but having the gene doesn't mean that you have the crystal, the structure, and to have the structure you need the crystal, and to make a crystal you have to read books on how to make protein crystals, and then you find that the interaction is mainly trial and error. Now, I mean, I this is a bit nasty to say it like this. It's not that like that, because this is a field where there's an enormous amount of expertise, so people know really a lot about how to make protein crystals. But which trick is going to work and which is going to fail, they can't tell in advance. So in that sense, there's a lot of experience, but what, of course, you would like to have is some insight into the factors that, that determine the physics of the crystallization phenomenon. Now, the interesting thing is that protein solutions, at least globular proteins, the one that, that live in solution in our body, that their phase diagram in solution is not like a scaled up version of the phase diagram of argon. So if we extend, we use the von der Hoff picture, replace the pressure of a gas by the osmotic pressure of the solution, then you could start making phase diagrams of, for instance, colloidal systems, where here you have the temperature, there you have the density. Now, if you have colloidal particles or proteins with a fairly long range attraction and you take a solution, you cool it down, you get at some point demixing into a dilute solution, which I'll call vapor, and a concentrated solution, which I'll call liquid. Of course, they're all in a liquid, but this, and then if you cool down even more, you get coexistence between the vapor and the crystal. And here you have direct crystallization from the dense solution to the crystal. So it's it looks like the phase diagram of argon. This is all two-phase regions. If you make the range of attraction short, and that typically means that the width of the attractive well is something like 15% or less of the diameter of the particle, then what happens is interesting. This critical temperature moves down and down. At some point, it moves below the freezing curve. So you get a situation where you cool the fluid down, and at some point, you have coexistence between a dilute solution and a crystal. If you cool down quickly, and after all, because of nucleation, we can cool down without immediately getting crystallization, you see phase separation into a dense and a dilute fluid. So you get the liquid vapor transition basically has moved below the freezing curve. Now, that is something that people have considered extensively for colloids, and the nice thing is that for many globular proteins, that really seems to be the case. So this is an experiment some 10 years ago by the group at MIT who looked at one particular globular proteins, but there are many more examples, most of them not published, by the way, where they've cooled down the solution at different concentrations. This is a dilute solution, and you see protein-rich droplets forming in a protein-poor solution, in a protein-poor solvent. Here you see protein-poor cavities or bubbles in a protein-rich solution, and in the middle you see something that looks pretty much critical. And so this is just an indication that below the freezing curve, because this is a few degrees below freezing, you have something like a liquid vapor coexistence curve that ends in a critical point. Now, this is one observation. The interesting observation from a protein crystallization point of view is that there's a group in Urbana, a group of Zukoski, who has been looking systematically at where you can make protein crystals, globular protein crystals, most successfully. And they found that actually it really depends on where you are in this phase diagram. If you're up here, you can wait forever and nothing happens. If you're down here, you don't have to wait forever, but what you see is you form quickly amorphous aggregates, flocks, that simply settle to the bottom. And actually almost all successful protein crystallization experiments have been done in this fairly limited temperature window down here. And so what we would like to do is to understand why. Now, in this case, a single order parameter is not enough because we're close to a liquid vapor-like critical point, and so simply looking at the size of a crystallite as our order parameter is not good enough. So we also will look at the size of any cluster ordered or not. So we take two order parameters. The one order parameter simply tells us, is there a group of particles that are at a higher density than average in this solution? And the other direction tells us, how many of these particles actually are in the crystalline arrangement? Now, if you have normal crystal nucleation, then all the particles in the cluster are crystalline. So you go along this direction. Here there are high free energy mountains, there there are high free energy mountains. Somewhere here there's the pass. You go over it and you form a crystal. If, on the other hand, you were to form a liquid droplet, then, of course, you don't form any crystalline particles in your cluster. You simply go in this direction, high mountains up here, and you go and form a liquid. Now, in this case, we will not directly form a liquid, but you can imagine that this is a possible route for formation of clusters if you have a liquid vapor critical point nearby. Now, if we then look at the free energy landscape for, we looked at a very simple model protein that is, again, a particle, spherical particle with short range attraction such that the critical point is below the freezing curve. We just tuned our parameters such that it looked a bit like the phase diagrams that people have seen for globular proteins. It's a really a poor man's protein model. And we find that in this case, the free energy landscape depends fairly strongly on where you are. If you're well away from the critical point, like 10% above or below, then you pretty much go, as I said, along the diagonal. High mountains here, high mountains there. You form a basically crystallite. You go to the top of the barrier, the critical nucleus, and you go on to form a crystal. But if you're close to this metastable critical point that is hidden below your freezing curve, what you find is that initially, the path goes pretty much horizontal. That is, you form a droplet. And then at some point inside the droplet, you start to form a crystal. And you go to a saddle point, and you go down to the final crystalline phase. And so the topology of the landscape is rather different. No, not the topology. The shape of the landscape, the free energy landscape, is rather different. More importantly, but it's something that you can't see easily on this picture, but more easily on the other, is that the actual barrier height depends very strongly on where you are. If you try to do nucleation at the temperature where you have this metastable critical point, you compute a certain barrier. In this case, the numbers don't really matter, but something like 50 kT. You go 10% above or below, and you find that the barrier goes up by 30 kT. And that means that there's a huge, if you assume that that dominates crystal nucleation, that makes a factor 10 to the 13 difference in nucleation rate, simply by changing the temperature 10% above. Yeah.
So make sure I understand what you're trying to tell us. If you're using the nearness of this metastable phase,
yep,
to make it easier to gather enough particles,
yes,
colors or whatever together to crystallize and thereby lowering the barrier, although that is not actually a metastable phase. And
that's right. Yeah.
Nucleating it.
That's right. Well, actually, if you want a simple physical picture, it's the following. The nucleation barrier goes as the surface free energy to the third power. If you're near a liquid vapor transition, you can imagine that the surface of the solid gets wetted by a liquid. So then you say, okay, now the surface free energy is gamma solid liquid plus gamma liquid vapor. At your critical point, and gamma liquid vapor is typically gamma solid liquid is comparable to gamma solid vapor. That number is 10 times less, approximately, than gamma liquid vapor or gamma solid vapor. So usually, the outer surface, the one between the dense phase and the dilute phase, determines everything. But near a critical point, that surface free energy vanishes. And so the only thing that remains is the relatively small internal surface free energy that determines the barrier. So there's something Richard Sear has worked out. A more detailed critical analysis of this phenomenon, where he can actually come up with quantitative predictions of how precisely this barrier behaves in the vicinity of the critical point. It's not such a nice parabola that we drew, but of course, if you have three points, you can only draw a parabola.
Have you looked at the actual macroscopic interfacial tension as a function of position along this line? Wouldn't the same phenomenon show up as an absorption layer of liquid that lowered
I think that is exactly what I would expect that would happen. Yeah. Yes.
Two questions. First, what can you clarify your model of what do you mean by proteins in your simulations?
Okay. So these are, as I said, poor man's. The problem is that if you look at the protein simulation literature, there's lots of people who have been doing simulations of a single protein. Then already quite a few less where people have looked at the interaction of a protein with a small molecule, some substrate. The number of simulations where people actually look at more than two proteins is extremely limited. Systems of proteins are just way beyond what anybody can do. So once you start to wonder about the phase behavior of large numbers of proteins, you have to go to simplified models. Now, a protein is a very complex object. I mean, typically you should expect that it's something with hydrophilic patches, hydrophobic patches, charges. And so it's a nasty, nasty, it's an interesting thing, but at this stage I call it a nasty thing. Our protein model is a sphere. I mean, typically we're physicists, right? So, and then it has a short-range attraction in such a way that the phase diagram of this sphere with a short-range Lennard-Jones-like interaction looks like the phase diagram that people have found for gamma crystallinity.
It's perfectly symmetric. There is no
reason. Exactly. So the shape, the hard core is symmetric, the attractive interaction is symmetric.
It's perfectly symmetric. Because isn't it clear that for object which you draw just above your sphere, there is actually a crystal phase?
No. Okay. So. At this stage, I could start a second talk that I would very much like to do. But actually, the non-sphericity of these objects is very important, not just for crystallization. It is very important for crystallization. It is, in addition, very important for where the metastable liquid vapor critical point is. And finally, it's extremely important for the gel line. If in order to form crystals, you would like to avoid gelation. And gelation is extremely sensitive to the anisotropy of the intermolecular interaction.
What does gelation mean?
In this case, it's simply that you cool the sample down, you turn your test tube upside down, and it doesn't drop out. I mean, that's my operational definition of gelation.
But from the glass?
Well, people in the field would distinguish between a glass and a gel, because a glass typically is something where you have a dense random packing that keeps the particles in their place by caging, and a gel is something where particles, due to attractive interactions, form a network with vertices that keep them together. Okay.
But your system is non-polar.
Sorry?
But your system is non-polar.
In this case, but of course, for the real proteins, life is more complex. Although this, still, that's why I show the experimental evidence. There is at least experimental evidence that if you cool, this is for the lysozyme, which has a similar kind of phase diagram where the fluid transition below the freezing curve. Vakulov and his people have done experimental nucleation rates in that system, cool down the sample to the vicinity of this fluid through the mixing curve, and they actually find that that's pretty much, actually it's not exactly, but just above that point, the nucleation rate goes to a maximum. And actually that it's not at this point, at the point of the barrier, but just before, is something that actually fits well in with, for instance, the theory that Richard Shear has developed to describe this wetting effect on the interfacial free energy. Okay, so it's just to show that the idea is not totally absurd.
Those three different curves correspond to three different proteins or something?
No, they're all the same protein, but I think they're all different salt concentrations. I mean, when they make these solutions, their salt is polyethylene glycol, they can take different length polyethylene glycol, and everything influences the nucleation condition, the crystallization condition, so these are just three. but they also shift the fluid coexistence curve. You see that as it shifts, so does the nucleation rate.
You mean the critical point?
No, actually, in this case, they were not at the composition that they would go down straight to the critical point. So what you're actually approaching is you're getting closer to the spinodal, which is just so. At the spinodal, also density fluctuations diverge. So it's not quite the same, but it's not something that it's close, but not exactly the same. Okay, so again, to say it's, so it's again not Ostwald-like in the sense that the pre-critical nuclei in this case are more droplets, so they are a metastable phase, or at least not a stable phase. And the critical nucleus, where there you have that the core is crystalline, and the surface is liquid-like. Okay, so now, doing time-wise, okay. What I would like to do is something where I can really start testing something else, namely, I can compare the Ostwald rule and the Alexander Montague conjecture. By looking at this a model for slightly charged colloids in the hard core Yukawa model. I'll come back to this model if I have time later on, because there are problems with the model, but typically the hard core Yukawa model is something that people have been using extensively to describe the interaction between particles with a Coulomb charge and screened interaction. So it's colloidal suspension in a salt solution, and kappa determines the bias screening length depends on the salt concentration, and you can get different ranges of the screening length and different values of the interaction energy. And the nice thing is that by playing with these parameters, you can change the relative stability of the crystalline phases. So you, in this case, you have done for a fixed value of kappa wheels. The other situation, this is simulations that were done by Azar and Mayer, who mapped out the phase diagram for this particular value of kappa and different values of epsilon, you have a freezing curve from liquid to FCC. Then at some point, as you make the interaction stronger, you have first a BCC phase, you go to still higher pressures, and that transforms to FCC. And here you have a second three-phase coexistence point, and then you go directly from fluid again to FCC. Now, if we are going to look at nucleation, and you're, for instance, nucleating here, then FCC is a stable phase, and if you're, for instance, looking here, then BCC is a stable phase. So it should make a difference according to Ostwald where you nucleate, but according to Alexander and McNaig, it should make no difference at all. So what Ostwald says is FCC stable, then the nucleus should be BCC. BCC is stable, then the nucleus should be FCC. But Alexander McTaig, on basis of the lambda theory, say it's always BCC. So FCC stable, nuclei is BCC. BCC stable, then the nucleus is also BCC. Okay, so what we find is that if you look at small nuclei, then they're always predominantly BCC. So in all cases, irrespective of what the phases that are finally are, they will always find BCC. So this seems to support the Alexander McTaig conjecture that certainly if you are still looking at fairly small nuclei that are probably better described by a Landau-like theory than really the bulk crystals where the order is already very strong, then indeed BCC is predominant. If you go to the larger nuclei, typically a few hundred particles, which is, for most cases, the typical size of a critical nucleus, then we find that the structure depends really on which phase is stable. So if the stable phase is FCC, then if you go to a sufficiently large nucleus, you'll see FCC showing up. And I just have one example to show that. This is in a situation where the FCC phase is stable. And here you see a way of characterizing the structure. See a few words about it. This is for a fairly small nucleus, and what we typically do is we have these different bond order parameters that allow us to distinguish between FCC, BCC-like environment, hexagonal closed, packed, ICOS or HEDL, you name it. And in this case, I just show the relative signature of FCC and BCC in the nuclei. You see they don't add up to one. That's because there's a bit liquid-like and a bit, small numbers. But the main thing is that in this relatively small nucleus, this is the distance from the center of the nucleus, actually, so the center should be here. You see that as you go towards the core, it becomes increasingly BCC-like, even though the FCC phase is stable, and there's a weak underlying BCC signature. If you go to a nucleus twice the size, same system, same conditions, the picture reverses. Now the core is more FCC-like, and the BCC and the core is FCC-like. And although you still have a clear remaining BCC signature, you see that it's becoming less and less important as you move to a larger cluster. So this is an example where you see, on the one hand, the Alexander McTaig scenario working on the small clusters. You get, indeed, small BCC clusters. But at some point, there is, well, I wouldn't call it a phase transition, but there's a transition in the nucleus, a gradual transition from the metastable BCC phase to the more stable FCC phase.
But yes. Oswald isn't right in either case.
No.
Yeah.
Oswald was wrong. Okay, so now, so far so good, but now we get into the more problematic parts, and that has to do with comparison with experiment. So I started by saying we can compute the barrier, we can compute the structure of the nucleus, but we can also compute the rates. And in particular for colloidal systems, that becomes interesting because there have been a lot of experiments. And so in this case, I will compare, I will look at the nucleation of colloidal hard spheres, and the reason why we do that is because, first of all, hard spheres have been studied so extensively by computer simulation and by theory that as far as the equilibrium properties of hard spheres is concerned, we pretty much know everything. We know the phase diagram, we know where fluid coexists with solid, we know the free energy of the different phases, we know the interfacial free energy between solid and liquid, more or less. And that's only in the past few years that we've learned that. But anyway, we know really a lot. The second and extremely nice thing is that there are experimental realizations of hard sphere systems because suspensions of uncharged spherical colloids, silica or PMMA, so glass or plastic, really behave like hard spheres. They have the same equation. People can use the light scattering to measure the osmotic compressibility, measure the equation of state. You can look at the freezing of the transition, and that all agrees effectively, quantitatively, with the theory for hard spheres. And then finally, there are experiments on Hartree nucleation. And these experiments are done by light scattering, so they're bulk experiments. They don't really probe the very early stage of nucleation. But they tell us something about nucleation. A number of experiments on Earth by Eckerson, Schätzel, and then Harlan van Meegen later on. And more recently, the Princeton group has done extensive experiments on in the space shuttle and our space lab, looking at nucleation of Hartree suspensions. And at the moment, but that's more or less what's happening right now, is that people are starting to look at the same systems using confocal microscopy. I'll come back to that in a minute. So this is just to show you these suspensions really do crystallize for some reason. I didn't bother to invert the picture as it comes from the journal. So the density goes up in this direction. Here you have fluid, then you see coexistence, crystal forming in coexistence with fluid. This is going through the two-phase region. Here you see the crystallites. And then as you go on into the even denser regime, you see large crystals forming. Eventually it stops, and that's basically because of vitrification. The crystals simply can't grow anymore, at least on Earth, because the system is jammed. This is a simulation, just a snapshot for a simulation of such a Hartree crystal. And I show this just to show, well, first of all, here you see the fluid-like particles according to our order parameters. Here you see the solid-like particles. And we cut it through a dense back plane, and you see something that typically looks like ABC stacking, which is characteristic for an FCC crystal. Now, actually, we, Stefan Auer, analyzed many, many crystallites. And sometimes we see FCC stacking, sometimes we see HCP stacking. But if you look at a large enough number of crystallites, we find that basically the stacking is random. There's no correlation between ABC, whether it's ABC or ABA. And so these crystallites are random stacked dense packed crystals. And you see that although the outside may look quite rough, the inside is really nicely ordered. Now, the numbers. So we have these crystallites. We can then start to determine the free energy of the crystal as a function of its size. And this cloud of points is the simulation data. And the curves are a fit to classical nucleation theory. Now, why a fit? Because in this case, we assumed that the interfacial free energy need not be that of the bulk solid in coexisting with resistance with liquid. And the reason is that coexistence point is at a different density of the fluid. Is the fluid density here between 52% and 53.5%? Coexistence is at 49.4%. This interfacial free energy may change, so we just simply fitted the data. And you see the fit is fair but not perfect. Now you get numbers out. So we find that typically the interfacial free energy in the appropriate units of kT over the diameter squared is around 0.7. It varies actually between 0.7 and 0.75 depending on the density. At coexistence, other simulations have given 0.62. And actually, if we extrapolate our data as a function of supersaturation and assume that it's linear, we intersect this point surprisingly well. Almost uncanny. The experiments have been fitted and the experiments, you can't measure the barrier, just measure the rate. So you have to make assumptions about the prefactor and then hope that everything else is the barrier. The experiments have obtained from fits to the nucleation rate a value of the interfacial free energy that is 0.5 rather than 0.7. You say, okay, I mean, that's different, but not all that different. Well, yes and no, because although the disagreement initially doesn't look so huge, you should remember that the barrier itself goes as the third power of the interfacial free energy. So a discrepancy of 20% in gamma already means 60% of the barrier. And then this barrier goes up in the exponent here, and so you may have, and if I go from 0.5 to 0.72, actually it may be a factor 3, actually. But if you put this in the exponent, it may have given absolutely huge correction to the nucleation rate. So small changes in interfacial free energy have large consequences.
Is the anisotropy of the interfacial tension important here?
It could be, but the thing that we fitted is an average interfacial free energy for the whole crystallite.
There is some kind of average.
There is some kind of average, and so if you look at the different data that people have computed, say with density functional theory, then the interfacial free energies vary. I think between 0.6 and 0.64.
So you're assuming a spherical. Are you actually measuring areas of different facets?
No, in this case, we simply, because I don't, well, I can probably dig up the movie, but if you look at the critical nucleus, it's fluctuating so wildly that there is no justification whatsoever to assume anything else than the spherical structure. We actually try to analyze the structure of the nucleus by looking at the mass distribution around the center of mass, expanded spherical harmonics, and see if there's any signature of, say, a rhombohedral or whatever, I mean, systematic structure beyond spherical. We found it was all in the noise, so we assume spherical for that reason. We have no justification to be more subtle. But I know that if I go to a large crystallite, sure, you'll get the Wolf construction, you'll get faceting, at least, but we didn't see it on this scale. Now, this is a very depressing picture, because what you see here is the log of the nucleation rate. And the nice thing, I should say first, is that we are able to compare with experiment because the experimentalists, in this case, did something that they never do. They express their nucleation rate in reduced units, which we assimilated like. That is, you divide the nucleation rate by the self-diffusion constant of the particle at infinite dilution. You multiply with the fifth power of the particle diameter, and you have something that's totally dimensionless. And we do exactly the same. And so here you get the experimental data. So these are the Harland van Meegen data. These are the Akerson data. Actually, I've been told the discrepancy between those two sets of data is only a factor of 10 to the 4, and that in nucleation is nothing, so I shouldn't worry about that. And these are the two space data. Now, the problem is that this is actually the curve you should compare with experiment, because the experimentally, the colloidal system is not completely monodispersed, and this is the monodispersed case. This is the 5% polydispersity that should be compared. And you see that our simulation data appear to intersect the experiment at one point, but on the whole, the discrepancy is many, many orders of magnitude, easily 10 orders of magnitude. Just for your information, we can really compute low nucleation rates. This level for a typical colloidal system is 1 nucleus per cubic centimeter per month. So the technical problem of computing very slow processes, that is no longer the limitation. But we have here a problem, clearly, because whenever you have this kind of discrepancy with the experiment, then typically, on the normal circumstances, you say, okay, let's forget it, the simulation must be wrong, there's something totally awful going on. The only problem is that with the hard sphere system, we don't have much freedom. We really think we know all the thermodynamic properties of the hard spheres. And also with the kinetics, so the pre-factor calculation, we did extensive tests to see if we could compute other things that were known. In this case, the long time, the self-diffusion constant in a dense colloidal suspension. And it all agrees, well, to within something that could, in the end, result in a factor 10 to 100 off in our nucleation rate, but never a factor 10 to the 10. So for the time being, I would say experiments are right, but the interpretation of experiments need not always be perfect. So that, and but the thing is that these experiments were bulk experiments, and I said, now things are improving, people are doing more confocal microscopy. So these are actually experiments that are done by the Waits group at Harvard, and they're very, very nice experiments. So I'll show you just
in this experiment. How can they avoid heterogeneous
nucleation? It's a very good question, and I have two answers to that. Can I switch off the microphone? No. Okay, so the point is that the way the experiments are done is they start with a fully crystallized sample and they shake it for a sufficiently long time and then say, now the whole crystal has shear melted and what is left is a perfectly normal liquid that doesn't remember anything of its prehistory. That, of course, is a bit tricky, because as soon as you have something, anything left, then that will act as a nucleation seed and will greatly enhance nucleation rate. The argument against that is something that Dave Waits told me, that using this kind of confocal microscopy. So you see, this is not a simulation, this is confocal microscopy. And the way to recognize solid particles is by using exactly the same order parameters that we did. Simply, we exchange programs. So at that level, there's no confusion. He simply said, if I start my experiment, the whole thing, there's not a red particle to be seen. So there's nothing crystalline there. Now, I should also say that at the meeting 1 year later, Dave said that maybe there is some heterogeneous nucleation. So I'm not quite sure what to say about that. It certainly is a concern. In his experiments, I should also say that he made very sure that the walls were coated with a disordered liquid of colloids of a different size, so that at least the walls could not act as a nucleation site. The main problem why I couldn't compare this directly with our experiments on the hard sphere colloids is that these colloidal systems are slightly charged. So their freezing density is about 20% lower than the density of hard spheres. And that really has an effect on the nucleation. But the nice thing is that you can see everything. You can see the critical nucleus. In principle, you can get interfacial free energies. And by looking at nucleation rates, you can compare with what we could simulate. So we actually did the work. This is something that we did quite recently. We computed the nucleation rate for soft repulsive particles. And again, we don't know exactly what the parameters are, because the parameters that characterize this system, in the Yukawa language, is the thickness, the bias screening length, and the strength of the repulsion epsilon, are not well known. There's a whole range of possible parameters, well, not a very wide range, but a range of possible parameters that could give you the same freezing density. And so we tried a few, but the only problem is that no matter what we do, this is our computed log of nucleation rate as a function of the density of the liquid. And these are different curves that should be pretty close to the experimental system. And these are the experimental nucleation rates. Now, I know of no theory that gives you a nucleation rate that doesn't depend on supersaturation. So that doesn't mean that the experiments are wrong. But I'll just try to explain in a minute why this could be right and that could be right at the same time. But it's clear that it's a tall order. In any event, we find that the nuclei, certainly the small nuclei, are always BCC. The experiments suggest it's random stacked FCC, HCP. So this doesn't seem to work. Interfacial free energy, we find an interfacial free energy is much lower than for hard spheres, but still at least twice as large as is quoted in the experiment. And the nucleation rate, well, you see, it's a disaster. So maybe I can say just a few things about, one thing about the possible the reason for this discrepancy, and then I'll tell you some interesting physics having to do with polydispersity. The thing is that if you look at these charged colloidal systems, and these are particles that were not meant to be charged, and that, so the colloids, they got their charge because in order to be able to actually visualize them and to keep them afloat, it's a gravity match, you had to use some fairly nasty solvents that made these things slightly charged. Certainly no salts were added. So it's an extremely dilute colloidal suspension of charged colloids. And in these systems, you can actually expect that the Bayer-Hückel picture is not a great success. You change the density, and the screening length itself changes. And so to just go back 1 second to this picture, I'm not sure whether. You can well imagine that at this density, we're on this curve. And at this density, we're on that curve. So simply, as you increase the density, the potential itself changes, and you do curve hopping. And so, although I still find this rather surprising, I can well imagine that the density dependence of a nucleation, the nucleation rate in a system where the potential itself is density dependent, can be quite different from something where you think, okay, the potential, like the hard sphere potential, is always the same, no matter what density. So, just to show that even at the level of comparison with experiment and simulation, there's a lot of issues to be resolved. But I mean, that's the nice thing. You only see that when you start looking.
What if you were to just naively say that the Bayer-Hückel screening parameter is just given by particle separation?
So
would you move horizontally on that?
Not never exactly horizontally, of course. But you can do. At the moment, there's actually a group in Germany in Mainz who have Thomas Paulberg and his collaborator who are trying to do accurate calculations of the different parameters that characterize the effective Yukawa parameters of the colloidal system. Unfortunately, they're again slightly different systems. For those systems, we don't know the confocal microscopy data, so we're just navigating in between islands of knowledge.
But enough is not about the experiments. You could actually see what would happen if you just put in interparticle separation.
I guess so, yeah. We haven't done that. Okay, so now something that I found extremely interesting, and that way we really go beyond Ostwald, because Ostwald never considered this. If you look at freezing of argon, and we know all argon atoms are the same, and there's nothing much you can do about that. But if you look at colloidal systems, then all man-made colloids have a natural spread in size, and this is called polydispersity. So the definition is simply look at the root mean square variation of, for instance, the radius of the particle divided by the average. And for most colloidal systems that people use in experiments, that is about 5%. So 0.05 is a typical polydispersity people look. And of course, they've been trying very hard in colloidal science to get the polydispersity down. So if you very carefully, you can go to 3%. There are a few experiments where people have been able to get the polydispersity down to 2 or maybe even 1%. What I will argue is something that's always a bit hard to say in the public of colloid scientists, is that they should go up in polydispersity. And that's polydispersity is, in this context, the P word. You don't say that in good company if you're among colloid scientists, because they hate polydispersity. And so the idea to actually take these very nice monodispersed sample and mix them together, they get something that's more polydispersed, not something they enjoy doing. Now, why is it interesting? This is the computed phase diagram of hard spheres with polydispersity. And what you see here is the density. This is monodisperse. At this point, freezing density, the fluid coexists with a solid at this density. You make the particle slightly polydispersed, and initially nothing much happens. You see that actually the freezing density of the liquid moves up a bit. You see also that the composition of the coexisting solid moves a bit to the left. For instance, here you see that more clearly. And that means that the solid is slightly less polydispersed than the coexisting liquid. Fractionation, very common. At some point, at least experimentally, this thing stops. If you're beyond about 12% polydispersity, you can compress what you like, you can wait forever, and nothing ever happens. Things don't crystallize anymore.
Is this specific polydispersity, like bidisperse, would be the same, or do you assume it's some kind of...
It's actually different. The phase diagram for bidisperse systems is a bit complex. But I would guess that if you go to this kind of polydispersity, the result will be effectively the same. I mean, the bidispersed system has a eutectic, and at some point it just doesn't like to crystallize.
So this X assumes some specific distribution.
Yes, in this case it was a Gaussian distribution. Yes. And for small polydispersity again, it doesn't make much of a difference. Now, what we would like to know is how this polydispersity actually influences the nucleation barrier. So we don't see freezing in these polydispersed samples experimentally. Now, there are two ways of accounting for that. The normal way that people say in experiments is, well, you have to compress the liquid more, it gets closer to a glass, and then things simply stop. But it could also be that the nucleation barrier itself is affected. And in this case, we are in a very fortunate situation because there are two predictions. There's one prediction says the barrier, as you make the system more polydispersed, the barrier goes down. And the other theory says the barrier should go up, or not quite. It's a slightly more subtle formulation, but at least it is compatible with the prediction that the barrier goes up. So what are the predictions? Well, the barrier goes down is basically Turnbull's rule. Turnbull has been doing, did in the late 40s and early 50s, lots and lots of very systematic experiments on crystal nucleation. At that time, actually, and pretty much still, the best way to get interfacial free energy, solid liquid interfacial free energy, is to look at the nucleation barrier. And from analyzing many of those experiments, he's found that there is a nice relation, phenomenological relation, between the latent heat of fusion and the interfacial free energy. You have to give it the right dimensions, so you divide it by the volume per particle to the power 2/3, and then you get something like an energy per surface area. And then depending on what kind of materials you have, for metals, the proportionality is 0.3, for semiconductors about 0.4, but typically you have a nice linear relation between delta H and gamma. Now, what does that mean for our polydispersed system? Well, here I draw the same phase diagram. The only thing is that before I showed you the volume fraction, here I show you the number density, which allows me to give you the volume per particle. And you see that here I increase polydispersity. At some point, you find that the fractionation is such that the volume, and therefore the density of the solid and the liquid, becomes the same at freezing. Now, normally we say the latent heat of fusion is delta U plus P delta V. But for hardcore particles, delta U is zero, so delta H is just P delta V. But if delta V is zero, then delta H is zero. So at this point, polydispersity of about 9%, delta H should be zero, and then Turnbull tells us, well, then it's very simple. In that case, gamma also is zero. So Turnbull says the barrier for crystal nucleation goes to zero as I get to 9% polydispersity. Now, the other prediction which is slightly more subtle, is based on the nucleation theorem. And it doesn't tell me directly how the barrier depends on polydispersity, but it tells me something about the relation between the barrier and supersaturation. And if I change the supersaturation of the fluid, so I change the chemical potential, and I look at the barrier height, then the derivative is related to the excess number of particles in the nucleus. That is, the number of particles in the crystal nucleus minus the number of particles that would have been there if there had been no nucleus at all. Now, if I go to a point where the density of the liquid and the coexisting solids is the same, then you can see that this thing goes to zero. So the nucleation theorem says, at this magic polydispersity of 9%, you have a very strange situation, namely, as you increase the the supersaturation, at some point, the barrier should go through zero. And that means that you can expect the barrier initially to go down and then to go up again. And so certainly not go to zero.
Sorry, that went by a little fast.
Oh, okay.
It's not the barrier that goes to zero, but the derivative of the barrier with respect.
Yes, that's right. And I'll show in a minute what it means in practice for the simulations. So what we find in the simulation, first of all, is as you make the system, so here you get the supersaturation, here you get the barrier height, and here you see the normal, the 1 over delta mu squared dependence of the barrier height you expect for the classical nucleation theory. Then you make the system, and these two curves, monodispersion, 5% polydispersity, basically make no difference. But then as you go to higher polydispersity, you see the barrier clearly going up. And in particular, if you're the 9% polydispersity is about here, clearly that is not what Turnbull would make us believe, because Turnbull would say if you're at 9% polydispersity, the barrier should go all the way down to here. So this is not compatible with a simple Turnbull rule. Now, something that we found even more interesting is the following thing, that if you increase the supersaturation even more, we find that the barrier initially goes down and then goes up again. And that is something that really has a huge effect for crystal nucleation, because you see that this happens earlier and earlier as you go to higher polydispersion. Now, unfortunately, our simulations became extremely sluggish if we went to 10% and we couldn't really go beyond. But we have every reason to believe that this effect continues as you go to higher polydispersity. And this is important. I hope that I've drawn this line. This line, this horizontal line, typically tells me what kind of barrier I need in order to have effectively something like 1 nucleus forming per cubic centimeter per month. And so once you're in this regime or higher, you will not see anything at all. Now, if you go, for instance, to a polydispersity of 12%, you expect a curve like this. That means that the nucleation barrier is always so high that basically nucleation will not happen on any human timescale. And human timescale is, in this case, defined as the lifetime of a graduate student, so say 4 years or so. So it's not that the system can't nucleate because the dynamics in the fluid are slow. It's simply that the barrier becomes too high to form a crystallite. So I guess prediction 2 wins in this case. The minus sign is gone. It's an empty transparency. Not quite what this means. Just one thing I wanted to show. If you want to know what it means that this barrier goes through a minimum, but one thing you could say is we found for the hard sphere system that the interfacial free energy itself, which according to classical nucleation theory is constant, actually increases with supersaturation. Now, if you just assume very simply that gamma increases linearly with delta mu, then you can see that, which actually is not quite true, but it's a first approximation, then you can see that the barrier has a term delta mu squared in the denominator, and a term delta mu cubed in the numerator. So you can expect that even with this very simple picture, due to variation of the interfacial free energy, you first go down and you then go up. Now, this is something that I can now at this stage only say as a possible mechanism, but it's not an explanation. I mean, so clearly you would need, say, a density functional theory or something similar that would allow you to predict how precisely the interfacial free energy depends on supersaturation and see whether this is the correct way of looking at the nucleation mechanism.
Yes. Confused about the nucleation theory. So it's delta G d mu is equal to the critical nucleus size.
Minus what would have been there in the absence of the crystal size.
The excess.
The excess, yes. Okay. So if the density of solids and liquid is the same, it's zero.
Okay, so you expect a minimum of the barrier if there's no excess material in the nucleus.
Yes, yes.
But that, I understood why the entropy should vanish at some condition. I can't understand why the excess material would go to zero at some point.
Okay, let's go back. If you are in this situation, then the density of the liquid and the density of the solid are the same. So that means that in a certain, yeah? Okay.
But that's the bulk density.
Yes. So actually what you're quite right. I mean, what you actually have to do is to first of all consider this not at coexistence, but at the supersaturation where you are. And then secondly, you have to take into account that the nucleus is slightly compressible. The density is not quite what it is. Under the conditions where you started. And so, but these are all things that are relatively straightforward to compute, although in this case I didn't do it, but yes, you're quite right.
And this takes into account the difference of position.
Yes, yes it does. Okay, it's 12 o'clock, pretty close to where I should stop. Okay, so I think that I've been talking a lot about the critical nucleus, and I really think that in order to understand nucleation, you have to study the critical nucleus, because that really determines what's going to happen from then on. Now, in many cases, not always, but in many cases, we find that the structure of the critical nucleus is not what is predicted by classical nucleation theory, so it was worth looking. We find that the barrier heights are also different from classical nucleation theory, mainly because classical nucleation theory assumes that all the parameters characterizing the barrier are those that you determine at coexistence, and if we go deep into the supersaturated phase, simply is no longer true. And one of the really outstanding issues at the moment, I think, is that the computed nucleation rates, no matter how we twist them, disagree seriously with the available experiments, and that really is I guess at this moment, something, the resolution of that problem is something that is still completely open. So to conclude, I think that we really would need better experiments and better theories to understand nucleation. But out of total modesty, I add one thing. Maybe we need better simulations. OK, thank you very much.
Now, where classical nucleation fails, are there corresponding density functional theories that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, there are a number of examples, in particular in the case of the protein crystallization, where David Oxby and his collaborators had a very nice density functional theory that accounted for that. We had another study that I didn't report on nucleation in Lennard-Jones crystal, where we find that the core is face-centered qubit, but the surface looks more like body-centered qubit. Again, density functional theory seems to be able to account for that really well. So I would think that density functional theory can really help us in understanding the microscopic mechanisms in those cases, and I think it really should be done.
In the experiments, particularly the one, not the ones that you were talking about, the ones in the Wace's group, but the other ones, to what extent does really the hard sphere colloid model really describe the colloid theory? I mean, is it really possible have hard sphere
collisions with a short range of traffic? Well, the experiments, I mean, if you take a normal colloidal suspension of uncharged colloids and you're not very careful, it's not at all like a hard sphere colloid, because you have the dispersion forces and usually you have some residual charges. So first of all, what people have to do is to take the solvent such that it matches the refractive index of the colloid, that way you can tune out the dispersion forces. They stabilize the colloids with usually some short chain molecules, so they have a very short range repulsive interaction, but that range is like only a few percent of the diameter, so that doesn't really change the hardcore nature. And from that moment on, the evidence is really by comparing the observed properties of the colloidal suspension to the computed properties of the hard sphere system. But it could well be that for everything we studied up to now, that was good enough, and for nucleation, it's not.
Yeah. Is the two-dimensional nucleation also a problem, or is it mostly three-dimensional? We have all this frustration problem.
It's two-dimensional freezing is of course usually a separate problem. If you look at two-dimensional systems, that freeze due to packing constraints. So like then you have a dense fluid and you freeze, then first of all, in almost all cases that I know numerically, it is still not completely obvious what the freezing mechanism is, whether it goes through a hexatic phase or is. In any event, if there's a two-phase region, is extremely narrow. And so you are basically never able to get into a regime where there's clear nucleation. We tried to look at nucleation barriers in simple 2D systems with some attraction, and we found that in every case where we looked, the thing all was, I mean, you really had to tell the system, don't freeze, please don't freeze, because otherwise it was gone before we knew it.
Because it's the first order, is the second order, is the
In many cases, it is either cost of the stylus or very close to it. But what you can do is to take two-dimensional systems and to give an attraction and cool it down so that you have the nucleation from the vapor phase. In that case, you can have normal 2D nucleation. And there, we actually see nucleation barriers, but I at this moment, we have not analyzed those data with insufficient detail to make any statements about whether there's additional interesting physics there.
Now, when you're near these spinodal and your simulations, you had the interesting two-dimensional phase plane route to crystallization. And there's so many surprises in this game. That's a stupid question, but is it right just naively to assume that the crystallization happens in the denser of the two fluid phases, or might the crystallization be favored by the interface regions where there are strong gradients between the two phases, or might the crystals even appear in the low density phase? That's a really shocking thing. Don't make any assumptions.
In the case that we looked at, we were not yet in the spinodal regime, so there was not yet a clear fluid vapor. I think that it's certainly true that if you were to quench a fluid into a regime where you get spontaneous demixing, that in itself could act as an ordering force that would facilitate nucleation. And I mean, just haven't looked and therefore haven't seen.
You couldn't look with the other any insuperable problems in taking a simulation down.
Well, the thing is, the only problem is that we want to do, at least in the barrier calculation, we want to treat these as quasi-equilibrium situations. And once you've quenched something into a spinodal, then all hell breaks loose. I mean, that's...
Yes.
Okay, well, there will be more time for any more questions or private discussion. Dan will be here the rest of the afternoon. So